I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Nancy Lublin, founder of Dress for Success, an organization that provides women with interview suits and career development. Nancy started the organization when she was 23, and Dress for Success operates in more than 70 cities in 4 countries. How did you initially come up with the idea to clothe women in suits to prepare them for interviews, job interviews?
When I was a little girl, my father once told me that when he was interviewing secretaries at his law firm, he would look out the window and watch them go from the car to the building. And he would know before they reached the building whether or not he'd hire them based solely on what they looked like. And I thought that was the most horrible thing I had ever heard. And I said, "That's terrible." And he said, "You're right. It is terrible, but it's the way the world works. So go comb your hair."
Wow.
It just stuck with me. I think especially as women, you know, you get dressed a certain way when you go out on a date. You get dressed a certain way when you go home for Thanksgiving. You dress a certain way when you have, you know, you see your friends or you're going to school or going for a job interview. There are uniforms. I mean, even if they're not, you know, pinstriped and they don't have a number on the back, we wear uniforms every day.
So did you always know, okay, I'm going to start Dress for Success? Or what was the idea or what was the catalyst for starting it?
The catalyst was that I hated law school. I was in law school. I thought I wanted to, I watched too much like LA Law as a kid. So I was in law school. I was miserable. And it was one of those cold, rainy February days. And I had, you know, my backpack on with like 5 textbooks in it. And they're all 3 inches thick. It was just awful. I got home and there was this envelope in the mail addressed to me with the return address from a lawyer in Florida. And there's a check inside for me for $5,000 from the estate of my great grandfather, which was really weird because he had died a number of years earlier. So I'd already mourned him. And I guess these things take a long time to process. But it was strange to get a windfall from the death of someone who in my family was like our Horatio Alger. And it was just really strange. And I got in the elevator and the idea literally came to me. He sort of rescued me from law school.
What did he do?
Well, he came from Poland and he was the 6th male in his family. And at the time, Jewish males in Poland were conscripted into the army when they reached the age of 18 for 20 years. So his family knew that his 5 older brothers were all, you know, doomed for the army for 20 years. And so when he was born, they hid his birth. They never celebrated a birthday, never sent him to school or anything. And when he sort of hit around puberty, they put him on a boat for America. And he came to Ellis Island. He didn't know any English. They asked him his birthday, and he didn't know. I don't even think he understood the question. So they assigned him December 25th. So we always celebrated, you know, my Jewish great-grandfather's birthday on Christmas Day, and although we never knew how old he was. And, you know, he became a peddler, like so many other immigrants. And he sold, you know, everything from bath mats to, like, I remember when he was selling pickles, just jars and jars of pickles. You know, he bought a couple shares of some company, IBM, and never understood why they sent him checks. He never, like, sold anything. He just hoarded all kinds of things. And I would just remember being a little girl thinking that I was helping him cross the street, and he thought he was helping me cross the street. You know, sort of that meeting of the generations. He was sort of more mythical to me than he was real. You know, the stories about him, because you can't really get to know someone when you're, like, 5 and they're, you know, 80 million years old. So it was really strange when he died, because here was this heroic American dream type person who started with nothing and, you know, worked his whole life and all that stuff. And so it's what was I going to take a vacation on that $5,000 or like buy some Jimmy Choo's? I mean, you know, that's just not right. You know, so the idea literally came to me in the elevator. Granted, it's a slow pre-war elevator, but by the time I got to the 6th floor, I knew exactly what I wanted to do with it. And of course, the joke is my great-grandfather and the rest of my family all just wanted me to stay in law school. I mean, you know, my great-grandfather probably rolled over in his grave at the thought of me starting a not-for-profit, you know?
The name Dress for Success is so catchy. Did you come up with the name in the elevator as well, or
No.
You just came up with the concept?
In fact, I fought the name. I thought the name was incredibly cheesy.
Well, cheesy works sometimes.
Cheesy totally works. And it was actually the nuns who came up with the idea for the name Dress for Success, and it took me 6 months to be able to say it with a straight face. You remember it, you know, it's kind of become like the Kleenex of that space. Everybody knows what it is and symbolizes. And no, it was a brilliant name. The nuns, that they totally got. We had a couple of battles about whether or not we should be giving out pantsuits. They thought the pantsuits were a passing feminist fad. So I had to convince them that both feminism and pantsuits were probably here to stay.
And they convinced you that the name Dress for Success
exactly.
works. Now, you keep mentioning the nuns.
Right.
What role did the nuns play in the beginning of this organization?
Right. Why would a Jewish girl from Hartford start an organization with three nuns from Spanish Harlem? It's a good question. So I was in law school at the time, like I said, and I was, I mean, new to New York. I really had never been here before. And so I went up to one of my professors and said, you know, I have this idea. What do you think? And he said, talk to Sister Mary Nerney. And my only interaction with nuns was like playing Sister Berta in the sixth grade version of The Sound of Music. I was like singing background and how do you solve a problem like Maria? But nuns are really cool. Nuns are, you know, Catholic social workers, basically. You know, all the Jews become social workers and the Catholics become nuns. Mm. I called them up. They were like, come on up. I got lost on my way to Spanish Harlem. I mean, I really didn't know my way around. And met with them. They understood immediately the problem. And each one had a different story of someone they were sending for a job interview who didn't show up to the interview because she felt she was inappropriately dressed, or showed up in an interview in like a Sergio Tacchini tracksuit because it was the most expensive thing she owned. So she thought that must be the nicest. And they got it immediately. So I looked at them and said, be the board of directors. And they said, no, go get a rich white guy from a bank. And I said, no. You know, I've got $5,000.
And was this still your first year of law school when you came to this idea?
This was February of my first year of law school.
And did you stick it out for 3 years?
Well, not really. I finished that first year of law school. My second year of law school, we actually started dressing clients. And fortunately, we found a space in the basement of a church that happened to be right across the street from the law school. So I would run back and forth in between classes. There's one class, admin law, that I actually signed up for, did not go to a single class, bought like the book that summarizes the whole thing. I showed up for the exam, and apparently there were multiple sections of admin law, and I didn't even know my professor's name. So I had to go to the registrar's office to find out where my exam was and took the exam. I mean, I was a bad law student.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Nancy Lublin, founder of Dress for Success, the organization that dresses women in suits for interviews. What was it like logistically in the early days? How did you get the first suits to dress women, and how did you find the women to dress them?
The nuns and I decided we didn't want to pass judgment on the women themselves coming to us. We didn't want to just be a storefront and have people drop in and we look at them and say, yeah, you're poor enough. Here's a suit. You know, that makes no sense. And we wanted to make sure they had actual interviews set, because you would dress someone differently if they were interviewing, say, for an entry-level position at Salmon Smith Barney than if they were interviewing for, say, being a preschool assistant teacher. So everyone had to come to us by referral only. So instead of screening the women, we screened the agencies. Any not-for-profit in New York City was eligible. This was also during the welfare-to-work era. It was part of a phenomenon called creaming. I don't know if you're familiar with that, like a hot chocolate or a coffee where there's the cream off the top. So we were helping move the cream off the top into work. So it was fun to come volunteer and see these women who were going to make it, most of them.
And these women who were coming to you, were they sheepish or embarrassed by it, or did they totally buy in to what you were providing them?
You know, there is no one stereotype of the Dress for Success client. There is no such thing as the welfare mom. I never met her. There were like Russian immigrants who would come to us and scrutinize every seam. You know, they knew the clothing and every stitch and where it was made, and they were really funny. And then, you know, there were the clients who came and couple clients who came, frankly, from prison and only wanted pantsuits because they were tattooed and they didn't want to show off their legs, or because they had never worn a skirt before or it was sort of too feminine. Mm. There were clients in just all different shapes and sizes, and like everything I had studied in life and feminism about the diversity of women, I was actually like living practically and seeing and interacting with. It was really awesome.
And how did you get the suits to dress them?
Women cleaned out their closets. I loved Atkins. I mean, Atkins really helped us. We got all of our, I mean, when Atkins started, we would get women coming in with full wardrobes. You know, that was amazing. And also the corporate casual hit. So like Arthur Anderson, when it still existed, right? Arthur Anderson went corporate casual and all of a sudden we had navy blue suits. And oh my gosh, I remember when Goldman Sachs relaxed their dress code. And we got some weird donations too. I mean, people would give us wedding dresses and blankets and baby clothes, even though we couldn't be more clear. This is women going for work. I don't know who wears a wedding dress to a job interview. And but we would get some weird stuff. One woman sent us a box of clothing and we opened it up and I swore the cat itself was going to jump out. There was so much cat hair all over everything. But I remember one woman from Goldman Sachs brought us a garbage bag full of clothing, and we thought, oh God, what's going to be in the garbage bag? You know, and we opened up, and it was all like Emmanuel Ungaro collection, size 14 suits. We were like, jackpot! It was always fun to sort through the donations.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Nancy Lublin, founder of Dress for Success, the organization that dresses women in suits for interviews. Did you think at the time that you were going to do this full-time and this was going to be your career, or did you think, okay, I'm going to do this nonprofit on the side and then I'm going to do something else?
Yeah, I had no idea. I was 23. What did I know? Well, I started out with that $5,000. The nuns told me to put it into a 6-month CD. I took financial advice from nuns. We started the organization with no money. And what was I thinking?
And speaking of financial advice, you do provide now financial advice and self-confidence and development training. How did that evolution happen?
Yeah, Dress for Success, we quickly realized, had to become about more than just suits. The public image is really about the transition from welfare to work. But a lot of the hard work actually happens in helping the clients keep their jobs. The other interesting thing about the welfare to work phenomena was that agencies were getting their public funding based on numbers. How many people could you move, quote unquote, from welfare to work? Mm. And once you got them into work is when you got your check as an agency. And there wasn't much incentive to help them keep their jobs. And frankly, a lot of people, the agencies, didn't have the background or experience. And so we realized, because we had this network of professional women donating clothing to us and feeling quite close to us, that we could start and we could help, and we were also last to see the clients and sort of in the most professional setting, so we created something called the Professional Women's Group. And that was solely for newly working women, for our clients who had moved from welfare to work and were now in jobs, to meet once a month to talk about working women's issues.
What are some of those issues that came up?
A lot of the clients had never had to have consistent daycare. You know, what does that mean? What's appropriate at the office holiday party? Just because there's drinks doesn't mean you should go hit the bottle. You know, what do you do when you go to lunch with your boss? Don't order the strawberries in January. You know, they're really expensive off season. Maybe don't order something that's like a finger food. You know, just basic etiquette that some people learn because you have a mom or a dad with a job or a friend with a job. But if nobody you know works in a big office building in Midtown and you're the only one on the block, you have no way of knowing those things. You know, they all emulated Oprah. They really didn't have role models and people to talk to about this. It's also very lonely when you're the only one on your block and your friends start saying, oh, you think you're all that now, or you can't help out and contribute to cooking or babysitting because you now have a job.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Nancy Lublin, founder of Dress for Success, an organization that provides counseling and professional clothes to women for job interviews. We'll hear more from Nancy coming up. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Nancy Lublin, founder of Dress for Success, an organization that provides women with interview suits and career development. Nancy started the organization when she was 23, and Dress for Success operates in more than 70 cities in 4 countries. What percent of the women who came to you to borrow suits initially actually stayed in their jobs?
It's a very interesting question. A lot of people would get starter jobs and then transition into other sorts of jobs. So you would start out with like an entry level position, or frankly, a lot of women would start out with like nighttime hours, which was totally not workable for their families and their lifestyles. So there was actually quite a bit of movement. You did, though, have extreme economic growth in the 90s, so they could get onto ladders. There were great training programs at places like Chase for bank tellers. I've never met a woman who didn't want to work. I mean, I say that. It's funny to say that now as I'm 8 months pregnant, and I know a lot of people who just want to stay home. But nobody wants to be on welfare. Nobody grows up saying, I want the state to take care of me. I want to go stand in line and get my check. I want to be part of that public image. Everybody likes having a sense of purpose and being part of contributing to the world and knowing that you're taking care of your family. And I think especially these women who realized that when they went to work, they became role models for their own kids. I mean, let me tell you a story. One of my favorite clients, it was a really, really busy day in the shop, and I was overwhelmed. There were so many, and I didn't have any help. And one of the clients just started helping out the other clients. Mm. She was just terrific. And I said, I want to talk to you. Let's get to know each other. Let's go have coffee. She had worked for what was then New York Telephone for a number of years, and then she had a child. And her child was born mostly deaf and mostly blind. Very hard to get daycare, nursery care, you know, babysitter. Very expensive for a special needs child. So for a while, she took a leave of absence from work. Eventually, that ran out, and New York Telephone said, sorry, see ya. Then she had no money. She stayed with her mother, which is also the definition of homelessness, by the way, is quite loose. A lot of people live with family to family, and they move around on couches, and that really is homeless. Her mother was taking care of this child, but her mother became sick. She was then taking care of both her mother and her child and couldn't work. And I said, what's different now? And she said to me, he just got himself a scholarship to the Jewish Guild for the Blind. And I love the way she said that also, like attributing it to him. I said, that's fabulous. He can go back to school. You can go back to work. She said, you know what? More importantly, I can be a role model for him now. She said, I want to go back to work, not just so that I can support us, but so that he can see that I can be a working mom.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Nancy Lublin, founder of Dress for Success, the organization that dresses women in suits for interviews. It seems like women came to you easily in the early days, and dresses and suits came to you easily. What was harder for you than you thought?
Oh, everything was hard. First, there was finding a space. This was in 96, where there was a real estate boom in New York. Every .com was paying, $40 a square foot for space. Everything was in my apartment for a couple of months. I mean, literally, the crisper in my fridge was where we kept the jewelry. Shoes were shoved in the oven. Clearly, I don't cook. The shower rod was where we hung all the blouses because it also got the wrinkles out. I took a broom and put it over two chairs and hung all the skirts there. And my bed, I slept on half my bed because I shared the bed with Sweater. So clearly I also had no social life. I mean, it was totally overwhelming. Large size suits. I mean, I talk about all these, Goldman Sachs giving us suits and Arthur Anderson. Those average sizes were about an 8. The average size woman is about a 12. The average size Dress for Success client is about an 18. So, that's why I said we really loved Atkins, because it was those size 24s and 26s that we needed. And sometimes when I say 24 and 26, people look at me and say, do you mean European sizing? No, I mean American. I mean good old burger eating American sizing, 24 and 26. And that was constantly a struggle. Wide shoes, large shoes, new shoes were always really hard. And raising money was also really hard.
How did you go about raising money?
I don't have a famous last name. I'm not a New York kid or socialite. I'm from Hartford, Connecticut. I don't have family here. I don't come from, that kind of tradition. So it wasn't like I could call up the rich uncle and say, how about writing me a big check, or the family foundation, to tap. Our first grant was from the New York Community Trust. We applied for a $25,000 grant so that I could hire someone to help. And I remember the woman came to do a site visit and interviewed me, and she was asking me these really hard questions and probing questions. And it was the first time that I'd really been pushed. And I was so nervous and wanted this money so badly, and I was so earnest, I cried. I mean, I bawled, like tears streaming down. Couldn't be less professional. Couldn't have been more heartfelt, so passionate. And she kept a straight poker face. She did not even hand me a Kleenex.
Ooh.
And I'm literally like wiping my tears on my sleeve and not like begging, saying, please give us the money, but just saying to her, this is so important to the women that we're dressing.
And
she left. She left. I thought we were never going to hear from her again, but we did get the $25,000. And I bump into her every once in a while, every couple of years in town. And we both just laugh.
Note, crying doesn't necessarily yield success every time.
No, it really doesn't. It really doesn't. And that was the first and last time. Look, the thing about being an entrepreneur is it's not a job. I loved every minute at Dress for Success, and I never put it down at 5 o'clock or even when I went to bed. It was the last thing I thought of before I went to sleep. I dreamt about it all night, and I woke up thinking about it.
And you woke up seeing it on your bed with the sweaters.
Exactly, and I rolled over onto it. I mean, it was all-consuming. And that's the thing about being an entrepreneur. It's you don't say, I think I want to start a business and I'm just going to figure out what it is. It's that you have this passion for something and you just have to do it.
It's a way of life.
Yeah.
So at what point did Dress for Success become your full-time job? I mean, you said at first that it was something that you were doing on the side. How did that happen?
Well, pretty quickly it took off. I mean, the need was far more enormous than we ever predicted. Agencies just kept calling us saying, I've got more and more clients. There were a lot of job interviews to be had back then, and there were a lot of women who really didn't have appropriate things to wear and lacked the confidence, which is really what we were doing. You're dressing them in like a coat of confidence kind of thing. And we wanted to meet the need. We didn't want to slow down. So it just grew and grew. And then the news media somehow got a hold of it. And it was such a visual. I mean, everybody loves a makeover. So there was such a good visual story. So we had a lot of media attention, and it just mushroomed.
But was there one or foundation or one company that was pivotal in getting you to financial health?
Yeah, you know, Avon was a really phenomenal company to Dress for Success. They gave us funding. They gave us pearls for all of our clients nationwide. So that every client left with a brand new strand of pearls, and the clients would look in the mirror and say, oh, my grandma had a strand of pearls. Or the pearls were so symbolic to them of being a working woman or being established. It was really wonderful. So they were really great. But I also had some great mentors at Avon, and Avon, just as a company about women and women entrepreneurs, was just putting me on the right track, mm-hmm. and they were just really good to us.
Was there one piece of media that really was an inflection point for the organization?
Yeah, there were two. 60 Minutes. And apparently at the Columbia J School, there is something they talk about there called the 60 Minutes Effect.
The Columbia School of Journalism.
And it's true. I mean, it really does exist. So we doubled in size after 60 Minutes. And then we were on Oprah, and we doubled again.
By the way, were your parents complicit or supportive of what you were doing?
There was no support whatsoever from my family in the beginning. They thought I was crazy. Just finished law school. Put that in the bank. Pay off your credit card debt. No support whatsoever.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Nancy Lublin, founder of Dress for Success, the organization that dresses women in suits for interviews. Now, you're also the CEO of Do Something, an online organization committed to getting young people involved in community action. Why did you move from Dress for Success to Do Something?
You know, I am truly an entrepreneur, and entrepreneurs get bored. You know, there are a lot of people out there who are still called entrepreneurs. They founded one thing and they're just managing it, and they're going to be taken out on stretchers. And that wasn't me. I mean, once I got Dress for Success to the point where there were systems in place and there was money in the bank, and anybody could run it, I was bored because I'm not anybody. I'm weird. And I'm not even saying that necessarily with pride. It's more like factual. I think it's one of those things you're born with that gene, and you're the person who sees a fire and you just go running into the building, whereas all the sane people stand outside and call 911 and, you know, watch the hunky firemen come put out the fire. Unfortunately, I like the action, and I get bored really easily.
Do you feel any stigma attached to the fact that you left Dress for Success rather than staying put?
My fear in life is that I'll die and Dress for Success will be on my tombstone. There are a lot of young entrepreneurs out there now who started things and left them in their 30s. And we all have that same fear. Mm. And we're all looking to be bitten by the bug again. And because it's that innate thing, It can't be something that you just decide, oh, I'm going to go into like the chocolate chip cookie space, or I'm going to start a clothing label. It has to be, oh my gosh, I have to do this. And there's this dying need, and I'm exactly the right person to do it. Where there are a lot of us sort of feeling that way and searching that way. The other thing is a lot of entrepreneurs, or people called entrepreneurs, really do never leave. And a lot of people ask me about that, and they assume that something must have gone wrong, or that the people at Dress for Success didn't like me, or I wasn't doing a good job. And the truth of the matter is, I emailed with 3 Dress for Success affiliates this morning alone. Mm-hmm. I still, you know, talked to them, and I loved it. But I really just feel like I could have died there.
And how old were you at the time?
30. I just turned 30. So that may also be part of it. It was like the 30-year-old sort of crisis thing. It was like time to focus on me and separate me from Dress for Success for both me and the organization. Look, I've always said there are czars and there are leaders. And czars build things and only leave power when their heads are cut off. And leaders build things that are sustainable and then they move on. I had no desire to ever have my head cut off.
I want to talk about your personal life during Dress for Success.
This will be short.
Well, why would it be short?
There was no personal life. I wasn't part of the equation. I mean, that's kind of one of the, like, the Dress for Success founding story seems to come back to me on a personal note. And the big joke is there was no Nancy Lublin. I was dressed for success. I went to, you know, college reunions and cocktail parties, and it's all I talked about. I went to Thanksgiving, and I tried to fundraise off my 92-year-old aunt.
And was that an active decision, or was it kind of taking over you by inertia and uncontrollably, possibly?
I mean, I hated law school. I loved Dress for Success. And I don't know if, like, do you not date and have relationships because you're super busy, or do you make yourself super busy because you're lonely? I mean, there's the classic. Now I sound like a Sex and the City episode, you know, and I could be Carrie Bradshaw on my computer. But there was like a year and a half in there when I didn't even kiss anybody.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I'll give you the real story. At some point, once Dress for Success really became successful and I was running Dress for Success worldwide at this point, and I was starting to get bored, I realized that I needed some sort of an outlet and a hobby. And I started playing poker. I started playing poker in illegal clubs in New York, in underground clubs in New York. And it was like me and big fat guys from Staten Island and New Jersey. It was my chance. I like testosterone-filled rooms. Big, I mean, seriously, big, fat, scary guys. And, you know, playing for money. And I loved that. It was like the whole other side of my personality. It's not a social life. This was before poker was on television and became cool. But it was like I could get out my competitive side. I wasn't the charity girl. And no one cared who I was. No one knew. And I could be anonymous and just think about the cards. And yeah, no, I had a real poker problem for a while.
And some testosterone around you didn't hurt either.
It was great. I mean, not like you're going to date somebody you meet in a poker club. Good
right.
Lord.
So you got bored with Dress for Success. But did you also say, okay, I need to get a piece of myself back as well?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I was 30 years old and I was still sleeping on a futon from college. And I still had, you know, like, make your own furniture from IKEA, and not even like the nice stuff from IKEA. It was just time to work on me. It was time to leave. It took me a long time to come to terms with, like, this is who I am, and I better learn to like it and deal with the fact that some people I come in contact with are going to find me too loud and too shocking and too, you know, weird and quirky, and other people are going to look in the mirror and find that I'm just like them. It took me a long time to find friends and get comfortable in my own skin. Fortunately, I met my husband basically 2 months before I gave notice and realized there was this whole other world out there, and I wanted to spend time with him. And
how did you meet him?
Actually, he also started a not-for-profit in New York. He started something called Cab Watch, which turned all the taxi drivers into the eyes and ears of the police and worked on driver safety and things like that. And we were both nominated for New Yorker of the Year and lost. We were standing in the back of the room making fun of the winner, actually, because he was a total dork. So we like to say that Brooke Astor introduced us because she sponsored the award.
And what is he doing now?
He's an entrepreneur. So he's one of the guys trying to put credit cards in cabs nationwide.
I need that.
Not as much as I do. So, yeah, no, two entrepreneurs came together, which is also, I mean, we made a deal for the sake of our children and our mortgage that we'd only do one startup at a time. Mm. So it's his turn right now, and then it'll be my turn.
Before it's your turn, you're continuing to operate Do Something.
I love Do Something.
The BRIC Awards is also part of Do Something, and the BRIC Awards honors young activists. Can you explain that a little more?
Yeah, the BRIC Awards, that's the award for young social entrepreneurs. So if you're 25 and under and you've started some kind of not-for-profit or program that's changing the world, this is like getting a Nobel. It's a big deal. And we're really trying to turn these kids into celebrities. I don't know why Paris Hilton is famous. I don't understand. I don't ever want to see her belly button again. And we're going to put 12 kids on TV whose belly buttons, I promise, you will not see. But you'll go deeper. You'll see like their heart and their passion and what they've done. And they're amazing.
What are some of the projects that these kids are doing?
So one of them, Kimmy Weeks, was actually born in Liberia. There was a coup. There were child soldiers. He was malnourished, thrown into a heap of decaying bodies, left for dead. His mom literally picked the bodies and found him. He vowed right then and there to spend the rest of his life working for kids in war-torn countries. And, I mean, Charles Taylor, you know, wanted to kill this kid. He posted soldiers at his school and everything. He escaped from Liberia, is now an American. He lives in Delaware, and he sends volunteers to places like Sierra Leone and to work with former child soldiers to get them food and reunite them with family and get them educations. That's what I'm talking about. I'd follow him now. It's not just about the future. He's 25 years old. And a lot of them are motivated by personal stories. So the kid who lost his mom 2 weeks before he started college. So he started an organization at college for kids with ailing or infirmed parents. And which actually there's a lot of kids in college who have sick family members. Or, you know, the girl who was bitten by a dog quite severely on the face and created a whole organization for treatment of animals, actually. There's some personal reason why they're connected to what they're doing, why they have that fire in their belly. Because being an entrepreneur really is, it's not a 9-to-5 or an 8-to-8 thing.
And speaking of fire in their belly, you right now have a fetus in your belly.
I do. You know, we joke all the time with both of us being entrepreneurs and having done, you know, social good type things. I'm sure this is a dentist in my belly, you know, or like an eye banker or something like that. I'm going to give birth to Alex P. Keaton.
And before I let you go, you talk about growing up in Hartford, Connecticut, but your family did have somewhat of an international outlook. For example, didn't you live in Japan when you were a high school student?
Yeah, I had a scholarship to... The American government and the Japanese government have this thing where since World War II, we've swapped kids, basically, every summer through an organization called Youth for Understanding. So I spent the whole summer in the rice paddies of Japan, which was good because I really was just a kid from Hartford.
And also you speak Japanese. How do you say, I found a dress for success and I'm having a baby next month?
I think I would just say I'm tired. I think I'd just say, oyasumi nasai, which is good night. I think that's all I would say to summarize that.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Nancy Lublin, founder of Dress for Success.
Coming up, we'll meet David Carmel, co-founder of Jumpstart.
I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is David Carmel, co-founder of Jumpstart, an organization that connects college students and community volunteers with preschool children from low-income communities for 1 year of mentoring and tutoring. Students from more than 60 colleges, including Stanford, Boston University, Georgetown, Emory, and Barnard, have teamed up with preschool children in the most at-risk neighborhoods with the hopes of tackling America's literacy problem. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm a pleasure to be here.
Where did the idea for Jumpstart come from initially?
So the original group of founders from Jumpstart worked at a place called Ramapo for Children. This is a residential summer camp in Rhinebeck, New York, which is unique in that it's got a one-to-one staff-to-camper ratio. The staff are college students who come to work incredibly hard with mostly inner-city children with a wide range of behavioral learning and emotional problems.
Then how did you then take that idea and say, okay, we want to expand this nationally?
We really struggled with the idea of how do you get this same type of individualized attention for low-income populations in the communities in which the children lived, but really be able to do it anywhere, not just as a residential summer camp, and really focus on language and literacy development. My co-founder was at Yale, Aaron Lieberman, and we started talking with Ed Ziegler, who was one of the national founders of Head Start under the Johnson administration. And he was very bullish on the idea and thought that if we started training and selecting college students to work with 3-, 4-, and 5-year-olds in low-income communities, that we could really have a demonstrable gain in school readiness skills for this population.
We take for granted that the foundation for success is established before kindergarten, and you have organizations like the Harlem Children's Zone run by Jeffrey Canada and Jumpstart, which was co-founded by you, addressing that assumption. Where did that come from? Why have we developed that assumption or fact now that the pre-kindergarten years are the most essential years?
it's a lot of studies that have been done that show that 80% of your IQ is determined by the time that you're 5 years old, that the most important skill for children to have in school is a basic literacy by the time you're in third grade. And there's a huge difference between low-income preschool populations versus their middle and upper income peers. And we figured if we can intervene at the earliest possible moment, that we could close this achievement gap between these two different populations. And that was really the need that we saw that we wanted to address with Jumpstart.
So your co-founder, Aaron Lieberman, is a student at Yale and you're a student at Harvard. How did you go about logistically making it happen?
Well, to be fair, there was a somewhat of a wider founding group, including a great woman named Rebecca Weintraub, a great guy named Jordan Moranis. The way we started is by sitting in our college dining halls and saying, hey, would you like to read with a preschool child today? We teamed up with a great preschool center called Jamaica Plain Head Start. And pretty early on when we started connecting college students with children at Jamaica Plain Head Start, we saw the same types of things that we had seen when we were bunk counselors at Ramapo Anchorage Camp happen in this preschool center in a very poor area of Boston. And that was children who came to us who didn't even know how to hold on to a book. Mm-hmm. Over the course of not months, but even just weeks, could sit down quietly with their Jumpstart core member, who was the college student from Harvard at that time, and start reading books like The Very Hungry Caterpillar, start doing activities to bring those books alive, and really take an interest in literacy from the age of three.
We talk about Jumpstart having a focus on literacy, but these children coming from these low-income communities, you know, often have emotional neglect and other psychological issues because they don't have the support coming from, you know, very functional parents all the time. Can you talk to me a little bit about how you dealt with those issues and what those were?
Sure. Our belief was we weren't going to take a professional mental health approach to this. None of our college students that we recruited and trained had that background. But we did think that if you get a highly enthusiastic and well-trained college student to work with a 3-, 4-, and 5-year-old, that they would blossom not just because they started to take an interest in books, but because they had somebody who they felt like really cared for them. And they had a fantastic role model for somebody that they might become.
What were some of the frustrations that you faced?
I think that the one-on-one connection generally worked. It's a matchmaking process. There were certainly times where a core member would come for a Jumpstart session and the child simply would not want to be with them. They were scared. They didn't warm up to that core member for sometimes several days and even weeks. We never really had a situation where eventually the breakthrough didn't happen, but it could often take time.
And how many students were you focusing on in Boston in the first year or two?
So the first year when I was still in college, busy writing a senior thesis and taking college courses, we had 15 college students working with 15 preschool children. We built that up over time, so we basically doubled every year. And then when we were able to do this full time, thanks to something called an Echoing Green Fellowship for public service entrepreneurs, we could really build that growth rate even more.
Incidentally, you mentioned Echoing Green. They're an organization that supports social entrepreneurs by providing them with some financing, among other things.
Yeah, financing definitely, but also they bring them together for a seminar on how do you create something from scratch. It was partially the technical assistance that they gave us, how you apply for your 501c3 status, how you do the bookkeeping and raise money and other things. But really, it was the example that they showed, the fact that we were in a support network of other social entrepreneurs, many of whom were in Boston, and that we could really reach out to. Because being an entrepreneur is incredibly exciting, and it can be fairly lonely as well. A lot of my classmates who were at investment banks or at consulting firms, while they didn't have the excitement of starting something on their own, they did have a structure and support network that we just didn't have. We were on a high wire without a net underneath.
So talk to me about the process of going from one or two colleges, and at the time it was Harvard and Yale students participating in this, to now more than 60. How did you think about that?
There was definitely a huge amount of tension in both the early days and as we started to grow more rapidly between the idea that you should really start very slowly, perfect the model, and then try to roll it out over time, versus those who felt like we could build the airplane while flying it. I remember when I did my thesis, senior thesis at Harvard, there was the idea between the hold and harvest, which is the go slow approach, versus the fixes fail, which is grow and you'll figure out as you're doing it. My own feeling is that you have to build the aircraft while you're flying it, that with scale comes opportunity, and you have to get to that scale even if you haven't figured out every detail of the program. We also tried to involve some real thought leaders in the space. So there was a guy named Jeff Braddock, who was a professor at Harvard Business School. He had spent most of his time thinking about how for-profit franchisees grow, bagel stores and donut shops. But he really used his brain power along with a board that we developed to think about how do we bring this nationally. And really the best way for us to do that was to reach out to colleges and universities to let them know about Jumpstart, but that they would actually apply to Jumpstart and we would help them start on their campus.
How did you support yourself in the early days?
I lived with some dear friends in an old haunted house in Somerville, Massachusetts, where I was paying $300 a month in rent. And that actually seemed like pretty decent living to me. When I first became an Echoing Green Fellow and Aaron and I launched this, we were both making $15,000 a year. And we begged a real estate developer named Danny Levin to give us donated office space, which he did. It was a small three-room office that had tons of mice running around, so we never felt like we were alone. And we sort of begged and scraped our way into forming this organization. We wanted there to be some sort of brand recognition of Jumpstart at some point. So we designed our own logo, which is very similar to the logo that Jumpstart still uses today, two circles with hands holding a book to show the one-on-one interaction around reading. And we called around to find the cheapest place that we could get T-shirts printed. We ended up with a place in Waltham, Massachusetts called Just Say Rock. And I remember going out there to pick up the T-shirts because, God forbid, we should pay a delivery fee. And we were the only T-shirt that was not a black T-shirt with a Megadeth logo on the front of it at this particular T-shirt place. So those early days certainly lead to some interesting experiences.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is David Carmel, co-founder of Jumpstart, an organization that connects college students and community volunteers with preschool children from low-income communities for 1 year of mentoring and tutoring. David co-founded Jumpstart while he was a student at Harvard College, and he's gone on to work in various fields of finance and stem cell research. In 1999, you had a personal setback. It was between Jumpstart and Stanford Business School where you had an accident that left you paralyzed. Can you talk a little bit about that?
After I'd gotten into Stanford Business School, I was traveling in Latin America and was paralyzed in a diving accident. And it really it was definitely the first time where I'd felt like I'd had a significant obstacle in my path. And although my parents had been divorced when I was in high school, I really led a pretty blessed existence. But this was definitely having to learn how to live life in a new body. And that takes its own sense of entrepreneurship to figure out how to take care of your daily activities in a new situation. I was had to use a wheelchair. I had no movement or sensation below my chest and only partial use of my hands.
Here you have this series of successes with Jumpstart going well. You get into Stanford Business School, and then you have this big setback in 1999. Do you feel like you perhaps weren't able to handle it as well because you had been used to a charmed life to some extent? Like, how do you reconcile that?
I think a lot of the response to paralysis is based just strictly on personality, and I guess I have a good thing going because I'm pretty darn stubborn. And I happen to just have a very optimistic view on life. And so the process of adjusting, while not easy at all, was something that I was fairly well prepared for. On the other hand, you know, the feelings of loss and of frustration were definitely new to me. And dealing with those and trying to incorporate that into my life and to feel like I could move on even when so many of the things that had been so simple before now were so difficult is something that I had to adjust to, and frankly, I still have to deal with on a day-to-day basis.
And how did it impact the decisions that you made, whether it be personal or professional, if at all?
I think the biggest one for me professionally, I was lucky. I wasn't a lumberjack or a dancer, something that was my career had to change because of my physical situation. I felt like I could still be an entrepreneur. I definitely got a lot more interested in the healthcare field, something that I spent a lot of time on when I was at Stanford Business School, when I was working in the Treasury Department under Secretary Paul O'Neill, and that I decided to do when I got part of the when I was part of the Prop 71 campaign. The Prop 71 campaign was really a grassroots movement from the patient advocacy community, started by a really visionary guy named Bob Klein, who had a son with type 1 diabetes. And between other parents of kids with type 1 diabetes, people like Michael J. Fox and Christopher Reeve, we created a coalition of people who could really advocate for an alternative national program in stem cell research. It just happened to be located in the state of California, where you can take advantage of the unique brand of democracy where 600,000 signatures gets anything you want on the ballot. So we had taken the restrictions that had been put on in the Bush administration on federal funding and created an opportunity in the state of California to push research ahead in this very vital field.
Is there any sense that stem cell research could help your ailment?
There are definitely people who feel like one day it may have applicability towards spinal cord injury. That wasn't my personal motivation. I sort of come to be comfortable in life in a wheelchair and feel like I'm pretty lucky given where I am. My situation is stable, and I'm not like, unfortunately, many others who are dealing with a disease or condition in which it's really degenerative. Mm-hmm. So I really thought of it for future patients, people who might not have to live through this, a lot of the same circumstances that I have, or different diseases, rather than my own situation.
You are married now. You have twins.
Yes, I do.
And you've moved on to now the field of asset management and finance. What role does Jumpstart play in your life now?
Jumpstart plays still a huge role in my life. You know, professionally, I've now started a new organization, and the experience of having started Jumpstart, even though I'm in a very different field, feels very familiar. The early days of trying to form a team, make clear vision, and to execute on that is very similar from those early days of being in my dorm room. On the family front, I now have twins, a boy and a girl, who are starting to learn to read. And that is so exciting for me because we spend probably an hour a day, whether it's 5 o'clock in the morning or 7 o'clock in the evening, where I get to spend time going through books with them. And that is just one of the great pleasures in my life. And I hear my daughter, when she does wake us up at 5 o'clock in the morning, saying, "Polar bear, polar bear, what do you hear," in our bed while we're trying to getting her back to sleep.
David, thank you very much for joining us.
It was my pleasure. Thank you, Jessica.
My guest has been David Carmel, co-founder of Jumpstart. To learn more about the show, visit our website at fromscratchradio.org, where you can download a podcast on iTunes, follow us on Twitter, or join us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.